Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron, and I want to welcome Finn Maxey to the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Finn is a permaculture practitioner, teacher, and evangelist. And
not comfortable with the last.
You're not comfortable with the last. Go on. You're on the radio. So I'd like to bring something new to my introductions. That was a word for Bill Mollison, though, wasn't it? You would have called him a permaculture evangelist. If anyone was, he was.
Yeah, I would say there are permacultural evangelists out there, so I don't think those two are incompatible. I just am uncomfortable with that being applied to me.
All right. Finn likes to tell us about permaculture at times, just quietly in his own way.
Sure.
So,
point taken.
Yeah. So every few weeks we get together and we have a chat about permaculture, and we've been working through... Because there's the principles, and then these are design principles we're working through.
Yeah, so we've gone through the domains.
The domains, yes.
Yep, and all seven of those, which, you know, people are familiar with previous conversations or more generally with some of the permaculture, I guess, kind of concepts and frameworks is the permaculture flower.
Yeah.
And now we're looking at the design principles.
Okay.
Yep.
And today's one is catch and store energy.
Yep.
And this seems really important in this day and age.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Have we traditionally wasted a lot of energy?
Depends on when we're setting the clock. So traditionally, no. No,
yeah.
I think humans have historically been generally, I don't know what the word is, not necessarily frugal, but we haven't had the energy surplus to be particularly wasteful.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would say pretty much all traditional and indigenous cultures appreciated the value of things.
Yeah.
And therefore, we're not wasteful.
Yeah.
But I would say in, you know, modern industrial capitalism, waste has become ubiquitous and taking things for granted.
Yeah, well, we've had so much with oil that,
yeah.
And so what that implies that there's actually a lot of capacity to, if we think about it and plan, to use that energy more frugally. Because we're at a point now, we've passed the peak of oil availability.
Depending on how you define oil, then
well,
that gets into a different conversation. But what now is considered conventional oil, which is a different definition than what we even used 5 years ago. So it includes a lot less actual conventional oils, but we have just surpassed all-time peak again. So, well...
I would reframe my statement then to say that we've gone past an oversupply to an over-demand situation and probably into demand destruction in some parts of the third world as well, I think.
Yep.
That's why petrol was around a dollar for a long time and then worked its way up to about $3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now sitting somewhere in between.
Pretty close to three, though, rather than one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that,
this
is not what we were going to talk about, but this is what happens. I really wonder how that's affected our economic systems in the sense that, because oil is behind almost everything we do.
Mm.
And it'll cost more now. So how much has that changed the economy? And I haven't... It's not like I've gone looking.
Yeah.
But has someone done a proper study on this?
Yeah, quite a few people.
Because we've also got neoliberal economics, which is designed to extract money from the people at the bottom of the heap and send it to the people at the top in a more efficient way than used to happen.
Yeah.
So it's hard to... when looking at the problems we have now, like, you know, people can't afford to pay rates and stuff like that, like they used to.
Yeah.
And the councils can't do their job properly anymore. Is there a simple answer?
Well, I guess in response to your question about have people research this, there's almost 100% correlation between energy and GDP. And so we generally attribute our economic, quote-unquote, progress with our, you know, our cleverness and our social values and a whole bunch of other things. But
yes.
In reality, when you look at all the metrics, it's actually our access to cheap, abundant energy that determines our ability to grow our economy more than, by far more than any other variable. So I guess looking at energy and this concept of catch and store energy is really important. And part of what I want to talk about today is, you know, is there a unique way of thinking about catching and storing energy when we're in, you know, what I would call late stage industrial capitalism, you know, when we're in this phase of overabundance, overproduction, and a wash in material surplus that a lot of it ends up in, you know, landfill or, you know, otherwise degrading.
It's a weird phase because we're actually suffering from shortages. Like there is a shortage of money in the system, but like you say, at the same time, we're awash in all this useless junk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and not necessarily useless either. So within that kind of material realm
Yeah.
you know, there is a lot of stuff that is built for disposal. You know, so it is junk. It's designed to be junk, essentially. Yeah. But within that, there's also a whole bunch of really useful materials that our ancestors would be horrified about what we throw away, you know, in terms of there's still a lot of really good life left in those materials. But because it's often cheaper or more convenient to go down the road and buy a new thing than actually put the time and effort into fixing it.
And we've got extreme ways to doing as much as anyone can to recycle stuff. And they have a surplus of things now, like they're having to turn down stuff to be recyclable. So we just can't move it fast enough.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, it is an interesting... So I guess, you know, that catch, the principle of catch and store energy is really interesting. And you guess you brought up this, for me, this really interesting point already around the relationship between energy, wealth, and economics. And I think just taking a step back, there's, well, in certain circles anyway, a famous economist from the last century. He died early 2000s, named Howard Odum. And he had a profound influence on the thinking of David Holmgren, one of the co-originators of permaculture. And he says, food, shelter, clothing, fuels, minerals, fisheries, land, buildings, art, music, and information are real wealth. Money by itself is not.
Mm.
And so this principle of catching and storing energy is really looking at wealth in a broader, more holistic sense and going, how do we capture and store? And so when we're talking about energy, I guess we can think of energy loosely in kind of two states or two qualities, and that's as a stock or as a flow. And as a flow is something that moves through. And so all we can ever do is really kind of harness it.
Yeah.
Yep. And if we don't harness it, then it will just keep moving through the system.
Which is a river.
Yes, that's right. A river is a great example.
The obvious thing. Yeah.
And then we have stocks. And stocks are those things that nature or humans have been able to kind of capture. So I guess this is where the pond or the lake, using that water metaphor, would relate.
And well, that's how we refer to our sheep and cows.
Yeah,
isn't it?
That's right.
We call them stock.
We do. And, and you know, there's the stock market, et cetera, which is, again, I'd say generally a flow, because until you sell it, it's not worth it. Anyway, it's a slightly different conversation. But from an ecological economics point of view, you've got these, you know, you've got flows and stocks. And stocks are the things that are kind of almost available on demand. And flows are things that you kind of have to work with them as they become available.
You have to go with the flow.
That's exactly right.
These words are really deeply embedded in our culture. I keep coming up with all these cliches and really obvious things that come to mind.
And it's interesting how they also have a very clear ecological kind of reference or framing. And so this this principle of capturing and storing energy is really about how do we you know, kind of observe what nature does and turn flows into stocks. You know, so how do we harness these natural flows of energy when they're available? And, you know, I guess they don't even have to be necessarily natural. You made a point about extreme zero waste. So, you know, all these materials that are essentially a form of energy, you know, energy's been used to make them and refine them.
Yeah.
How do we hold on to them and make good value of them while they're in our system? Because, you know, a typical transfer station, a waste transfer station, just collects stuff and then sends it on.
Assumes it's waste.
Yeah.
So, okay, now you're talking about those things as a form of energy. That makes the definition of energy interesting because, like, you take a T-shirt up and it, and you're calling that in this context a form of energy. And it could
be a store of energy.
A store of energy.
Yeah.
And you could burn it to keep yourself warm
and
release the energy.
Totally.
But so that's like a very literal definition of this shirt as
That's how you might release that energy.
Yeah, as a store of energy, but it's also a store of energy in the sense that it can keep us warm and do other things.
Yeah, that's right.
So
it becomes an extra layer of skin, essentially.
So you're using the word energy in a kind of a very broad sense because of this?
Yeah, well, so I guess there's energy and then there's stores of energy. And so from an ecological lens is, you know, the primary way in which nature stores energy is through photosynthesis.
Yeah.
So the creation of carbon or, you know, cellulose. And the process of photosynthesis. And so you take diffuse photons and you turn them into, you know, wood or, you know,
fruit,
a ligament or something like that. And then you can use those in a range of ways to meet one's needs. And so, so I guess I am using energy both as this concept of a store, so materials that accumulate, as well as I guess, the more literal sense of like a joule or a or a watt.
So it, almost everything is stored energy, isn't it, really?
Well, from a physics point of view, is energy dissipates, right? Entropy.
Yeah,
But everything that is able to be captured for a period of time is, generally probably some store of wealth, right? And whether it's actually useful to us or not depends on a whole range of things.
So stored energy equals wealth?
I guess not always, because I wouldn't necessarily relate to degraded nuclear waste as a valuable store of energy.
But it's a permaculture thing to see everything as a resource.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I'm just trying to think of, you know, you're asking a question that's kind of essentially a truism, so I'm trying to get my head around it and go, is that true in all situations? But generally speaking, I mean, I think that's a healthy orientation, is to see everything as a, you know, and a resource, I guess, has that assumption that it's there for human use, but to see things as something that has potential use or value, I think is quite a useful reorientation.
I was just trying to get, like we always think of energy as electricity or sunlight. Mm-hmm. Like that's the first stuff that comes to our mind. And then stored energy means it's a battery. So obviously permaculture is taking that wider, because our food is stored energy.
Yeah.
We cut our crops and we store them in the storehouse. Then that's stored energy. But in permaculture, you seem to be talking about it in a much wider sense, that like the T-shirt, the T-shirt is stored energy.
So I might give you some examples of sources of energy. Yep. So we've got solar energy, which we've talked about.
Yeah.
And we can use that to, you know, dry wood. We can use that for clothing and for cropping, to dry our crops, to dry our clothes. And we can use it for passive solar design as well. So we can use it to heat and cool our houses and how we move things. We've got, wind energy, which is a derivative of solar, but I won't get into that. We can use that for pumping and for creating electricity. We can also use solar for that in the form of photovoltaics, right? There's more to it than just taking the photons. But and then we've got things like biomass, so plant material. And we can use that for fuel, as you alluded to, in the instance of a T-shirt. But we could also look at, you know, a log or other types of biomass that are probably better as fuels and as construction materials. And then we can look at things like water and rain. Through gravity, essentially having our sources of energy, because we can use them for irrigation. Not so much in New Zealand, but there are instances where we can at least consider it for aquaculture and for, again, electricity generation. But then that next bit where I was talking about the stores is thinking about, you know, how do we store energy in the landscape? We can be thinking, the three key energy stores are water, living soils, trees, and seeds. And so all of those are, I guess, have energy potential in them, for lack of a better way of saying it. And then we can use those. You know, a seed, if we put it in the right conditions, is going to grow a plant. Living soils are going to grow a healthy soil ecology, which then can support a whole range of life. If we're thinking about trees, they have the ability to capture photosynthesis and regenerate themselves. And then in the instance of water, we can use that for, again, as we talked about before, you know, a whole range of different things.
As a permaculturist, do you see the world in terms of energy flows, and perhaps in the way an economist might see the world in terms of financial flow or money flow?
I don't know how economists think.
No, I'm guessing, because I think they don't do that enough, I don't think. But
I would say so. I mean, energy literacy and understanding how biological systems work is fundamental to the permaculture concept.
Yeah, okay, all right.
So understanding energy flows. So, it's not a coincidence that permaculture started with this concept of a forest garden, that was looking at, well, how does nature rebuild and replicate itself using the very limited amounts of energy?
Did it not also start around the time of the energy crisis in the 70s?
It did. Yep.
Yeah.
So again, that would have been...
which prompted a lot of this sort of thinking.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. All right, I was just getting my head around how fundamental energy is.
Yep, to everything.
Because we don't think about it in conventional life that much.
The reason we don't is because we're awash in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So for us, energy comes from, you know, the tap or a light switch or a button. You know, at no time in any previous society has that been the case. You know, we had a day-to-day intimate relationship with energy because it was either us or animals.
It's like asking a fish what water is.
Yeah, that's right.
But we are aware of financial flows. Yeah. And I'm just, this is what I'm getting my head around. We should be as, permaculture is basically telling us that we should be as aware of energy flows as we are of our financial flows.
No, I think permaculture is telling us we should be more interested in energy flows because energy flows determine economic flows.
Yes.
Yep, but we take that for granted now because we're energy blind.
But if we pay that much attention as we do to our money, energy, then that would be a good start.
Yeah, like why is the world not going, oh, GDP is directly pegged to energy use. The more energy we use, the more economic growth we have. You know, that insight alone should is quite profound, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So no economic growth without energy.
So, and of course, the point you made that the economy is reliant on the energy is that with cash and store energy and permaculture, you can sidestep the economy with your own, you catch and store your own energy.
Well, that is your own economy. So again, for me...
Okay, when I say economy, I'm talking about what we conventionally think of as the financial economy.
Oh, yeah.
With money, dollar signs flowing back and forth.
Sure.
We can sidestep that by growing your own food, harvesting your own crops, collecting your own water, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, all traditional economies were based on that stuff, right? They were based on working with natural energy flows that were available and organizing society around those, essentially. I mean, I can't overstate the role of energy in human social organization. It's core.
Okay, so back to catch and store energy. What's your advice?
Yeah.
Is that where we're going?
Well, I don't know if it's advice, but I'm keen to unpack this principle and kind of how it's relevant today and how we can start thinking or applying it in our day-to-day lives. So this principle is really about the capture and long-term storage of energy. So it's really about savings and investments. It's about building natural and human capital. So again, we talk a lot about financial capital, but if we think about human capital as all those skills and knowledge sets that are built up over a lifetime, how do we use natural flows to kind of reinvest and build up our land-based knowledge sets again, but then also natural capital. So, you know, from where I'm standing, we have an incredibly degraded life support system. That's globally, but also at local levels. And that's largely, I think, because of the cultural values that have developed through a certain economic orientation, which is about extraction.
Yeah.
You know, extraction, you know, kind of a plunder type colonial mindset towards the natural world,
and which has been enabled by that decoupling of our thinking. Now we think in terms of finance, and it's mentally we've decoupled that from the real world energy stores and the resources and everything.
That's it. And we don't have those real time feedbacks anymore in the same way for those, you know, in our day to day lives where, you know, we turn on the tap and there's pretty much always water. We turn on the switch and there's always electricity. Whereas so noticing those kind of micro changes in our local environment to say, ooh, things aren't quite right, is I think one of the things that's enabled that process to continue for so long.
Yeah.
So we need to learn to save and reinvest most of the wealth that we're currently using or wasting so that, you know, future generations might have a reasonable life. And so that's where one of the reasons why I think this principle is particularly important, given we live in a locally, nationally, and globally degraded environment. You know, the next at least generation, but I would say the next couple generations, if we were really Homo sapiens, if we were wise apes, we would actually be reinvesting in long-term stores of wealth that, you know, would add benefit to current living generations, but would do wonders for ecological stability at a range of scales.
So what are long-term stores of wealth in that context?
Yeah, well, so some of them, I think, are things that I've mentioned. So forests, extensive seed banks and seed diversity.
Yeah.
a range of different kind of water catchment systems where we're able to continually rehydrate our landscapes and ensure that our aquifers are recharged and are kind of full. So again, that mitigates, if it's not obvious, against things like drought. Other storms of real wealth would be rebuilding our apprenticeship and mentoring models, or to a kind of Taina type relationship, so that a lot of that traditional knowledge and wisdom is passed forward. We'd be reinvesting in, I don't know if reinvestment's quite the right word, but in some ways I think it is, in Maramataka. And, you know, this ancient wisdom of how to work with the natural flows, the natural energy flows, so that we can apply it to, you know, our day-to-day lives in a really rich way. And, you know, people are certainly doing that. One of the things that I notice, for example, is a lot of the Maramataka that I have access to focuses on, you know, fishing and gardening. And I think that's awesome, but I'm interested in also things like, when are good times to plant trees, and when are good times to prune, and when are good times to, you know, some of that stuff more around forest regeneration and maintenance. Yeah. And no doubt there are those natural cycles and rhythms. So how do we kind of tune into those? So all of those are, for me, examples of how we do that. Another one, I guess, would be, how do we use the natural endowment of this bioregion, of what's abundant in Whangaroa? Well, so we have really good clays here, as an example.
Yeah.
So should we be considering building centers of learning around ecological buildings that really work with our natural materials? So we could be using fibers that we can grow generally really well in summers, and then the clays that we have, so that we're building stock that is going to stand the test of time and is locally rebuildable. So those are some examples of some of the things, you know, investing in forest gardens and living seed banks. So we have these repositories, these arboretums, where a lot of the plants that we might need, and, you know, in that we might have certain microclimates where we're growing things that are slightly on the edge, you know, are more in that subtropical, tropical space that right now might be a bit marginal. And we're trying to grow stuff that might be more in that cold temperate, as opposed to, you know, we're in a cool temperate zone. And with climate change, we might, you know, things might get colder, and therefore we have local plants that are adapted to that. Or maybe, as the colder modeling suggests, colder things are... Well, I'm just saying here, right, is I'm... for me, there are some question marks around, you know, climate chaos, I feel, is kind of a better term.
So localized than, cold.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, for example, a lot of my plants just got hammered 2 weeks ago with those, you know, we had four frosts in a row.
Yeah.
And two of them were particularly bad. And so...
Where are you again?
Te Uku.
Yeah, so you're far enough from the sea that you're getting...
Yeah, well, we've got a big headland frost in front of us.
Yeah.
So just an example is, you know, it could conceivably get colder, but not necessarily as an average. But how do we buffet against those margins?
So it might be getting subtropical with frosts at the wrong time.
Yeah. So there are elements of that.
Well, and from year to year, yeah.
And so using things like dams and ponds can, you know, mitigate some of that local climate, but also reinvesting in our soils.
That's true, actually. That's an interesting question. Like, we all know that, like, people who are probably on the beach don't get frosts.
Yeah.
That if you have to be a long way south to get that.
Yep.
But you only have to go a few k's inland, you get frosts. How big does your pond have to be to make it like you're living at the beach?
Well, and I think for me, I'm not... Yeah, so I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not super inclined to spend a whole bunch of time on it, but my orientation around that is, yeah, how big does the pond need to be so that I can start extending my ability to grow subtropical foods?
Yeah.
I can go to the beach if I want to. You know, it's a 10-minute walk from my house. But or at least the water is. But so I'm not trying to replicate the coast on my land. I'm trying to replicate a slightly warmer climate so that I can protect some of the plants that I want to grow until, you know, I have a more proper canopy cover. And so all of this for me is about those kind of catches and storing energy. So how do I work with these flows? And the flip side of that is, how do I work with the frost and accentuate the frost?
Because the frost works for some plants, doesn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of plants that need a good cooling to set proper fruit or nut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we see plants around where they look like they're confused by the climate, like there's new growth and old growth at the same time.
Yep.
And yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So catching and store energy, I guess, has lots to it, but in essence it really is about kind of paying it forward. How do we use the flows while they're available and invest them in long-term energy stores that we can use later, but also future generations can use?
So, I just want to kind of not separate, but like I mean, we talk about energy and batteries and things like that, but you can also store energy in your house.
Totally,
like solar energy in the house, and that can, and
thermal
that can,
mass,
yeah, and thermal mass, and that can work through not just the week but through the year. So your summer storage can work for winter. It can even go longer than that. Those are the more obvious things, but really long term, you're talking about like creating a forest that's going to support future generations. What other have we got? Other things?
Yeah, well, soils is, I think, really good.
Healthy soils even more important than the forest.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you get healthy soils, you can build your forest much quicker, right?
Yeah. So that's a really important, and that's what we've degraded a lot.
Yeah.
Because we've been able to, because of artificial fertilizers.
Yeah.
Get away with it for a while. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Right. So those are two examples.
But also, actually, something that they do, I've heard other permaculturists talk about, is like, while we've got machinery and oil, we can like do things like build swales easily and stuff like that, which then sets us up for the future.
Yep,
that's a good way of investing current energy in.
I think it's about using what we've got now, I would say that is there is a catch and store energy component to it, but in some ways you could also say you're just using energy that's available now to then store different forms of energy later, which seems like a reasonable strategy to me.
Yes.
You know, we're awash in fossil carbon right now.
Yeah.
And so it's not to say we might as well be frivolous about how we use it, but, I've dug enough holes and moved enough soil to know that earth-moving machinery is pretty extraordinary in its ability to do work.
Especially out here with clay.
Yeah.
I've been intimately acquainted with the qualities of the clay locally over the years.
Yep.
I remember one time at my parents' place in Hamilton digging a hole in the soft, loamy soil. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I couldn't believe how easy it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, clay's hard work.
Clay is hard work. Yeah. So again, how do we work with that clay?
Yeah.
So
Finn is contemplating his notes.
Well, yeah, so I guess I'm just thinking about kind of where to from here. What's the best way? So maybe just stepping it back to biology is, so all living systems, or all self-organizing systems, most of which are living, have this ability to harness energy when it's available and store it for shortened periods, for periods of time.
Yeah.
And so again, what we're talking about here isn't something that's kind of made up or come from nowhere. It's come from observation of how nature works and how nature self-organizes. And a little bit of a tangent, but I've been reading a whole bunch of stuff lately that's quite fascinating. But one of those kind of great questions out there is, how does life exist at all, given entropy? You know, so our understanding of the universe through physics is pretty extraordinary, but we need a new science for biology, because physics says, not quite, but almost states that life can't exist because...
it's missing something then, isn't it?
It is. And so that's why biology is kind of almost an antithesis. It's not... It doesn't defy the laws of physics, but it works in spite of the laws of physics. And so despite the fact that there's always this movement towards disorder and kind of degradation of energy across a gradient, life does the exact opposite. It's able to take energy where it's available and build on that to create new and different stores of energy.
It is creative.
That then can build and store new forms of energy. And so this principle is really about, how do we tap into that? How do we tap into that miracle of life principle, which is about using what our environment provides us in a way that doesn't degrade that natural source, but actually builds off of it and creates more complexity, more richness, more abundance.
You keep using the word create, and as life is creative.
Absolutely.
And that's what we have to be, and that's what permaculture is. It's a very creative, it's not a set of solutions, it's more than that, it's a way of thinking. But
for me, it's absolutely a way of thinking.
Yeah, it's deploying creativity, I think, and that's...
through an ecological lens. So I think there is this sense of, like, you know, life's been at it for, you know, 4.4 billion years, and we'd be incredibly wise to step back and spend more time, again, coming back to the first principle, observing. Catch and store energy, to my mind, is just a way of applying those skills of observation to go, you know, how does nature do that? How does nature defy the second law of thermodynamics? and one of the ways it does that is it catches and stores energy at every available opportunity. And so why then are we doing the opposite and we're dissipating energy at a far greater rate in our global society? We're not really catching and storing it as a cultural goal.
So where's the energy going? Because it doesn't. Because another law is that it doesn't disappear.
It dissipates. It transforms, right? So it becomes less and less valuable.
Becomes heat, I guess.
Depending on what we're talking about, but essentially, yeah.
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 But then we get heat from the sun, and there's the issues of global warming and all the ozone and things like that. Because the sun could deposit a lot more energy on us.
Yeah. And again, through this amazing creative process, the biosphere has created the perfect filter to block out some of the... Yeah, I mean, it's quite an amazing process. The more you kind of look into, I guess, Gaian theory and how the biosphere has come to self-organize. And I guess trying to extrapolate that for us in our kind of day-to-day is, what are those natural flows that are moving through? And so, you know, an example for me, just in my observations, is, you know, Raglan's quite a destination. Lots of people love to come here for a whole range of reasons. Through that process, there's an importation of a whole bunch of skills, a whole bunch of knowledge, a whole bunch of expertise. And how much of that as a community do we actually kind of tap into and harness while it's here?
We need to catch and store these people.
Yeah, and store...
Sounds slightly gruesome.
Well, the store part doesn't have to be a physical... You know, it's in some ways it's about, you know, storing that intellectual capital in different forms. So, you know, that's where those tuakanatena type relationships become really important. Because as we know, you know, people die, right? People pass on. But knowledge can be retained so long as it's shared. And so I think that's, for me, an example of where those people don't have to physically remain in Whangaroa for some of their human capital to be kind of reinvested in here.
That's where knowledge is different.
Yeah, that's right.
Knowledge, you don't hold a piece of knowledge. You don't lose it when you give it away.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
No, but it is also incredibly vulnerable too, because knowledge can be lost really quickly. You know, we have our tohunga of whatever sort, and, you know, there's whatever it is, a car accident, an illness or something. If that knowledge hasn't been passed on, then it ends there. And we've seen that process.
It also gets lost in a sea of TikTok videos.
Yeah, totally.
Like, we're so overwhelmed with information at us all day that, yeah, the skill used to be finding the information and finding the knowledge.
Yeah.
Now the skill is discerning where the useful stuff is.
The signal from the noise.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. That is particularly challenging because you learn you when you get overwhelmed with information, you also lose your ability to analyze and discern.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think it's an interesting, I'm not sure, I'm just exploring this, is so we talked about physics and entropy, and that's kind of a natural process, a generalized law in the universe. Does that apply to knowledge as well? So I've got something here that says, the capacity of landscapes to hold water, minerals, nutrients, and organic matter is limited and is always being eroded by the inexorable forces of gravity, right? So there's entropy at play. And so, well, we need things like water, minerals, nutrients, and organic material to run our global civilization, or any civilization needs those. They are they too fleet. And I know there's lots of work that's been done around why previous civilizations have failed, and there's a lot of correlation between their misuse or mismanagement of soils and soil health and essentially ecological collapse, which then leads to societal disintegration. And so I don't know how much it compares there, but essentially, you know, given that these things are, we can store them long term and they degrade, what are the strategies we can put in place to reduce that level of dissipation? And so, you know, if we do nothing, all of our hills will eventually kind of flatten out through a process of erosion. So that's kind of inevitable, right? So all of the hills in and around Whangaroa will, given enough time, basically leach out all of their minerals and all their sediments and become, you know, kind of a much more flat landscape. So we're, you know, imagine a kind of a, loosely speaking, an Australian, a more Australian-like landscape, which is much flatter because all of their soils have been eroded over a much longer time frame. What are the things we can be doing to slow down that process and work with those natural cycles? So this is, in essence, what this principle is about for me.
I'm interested in this and the concept of entropy, which is coming from physics. It reflects our cultural mindset of linear thinking.
Yep.
There's a beginning and an end, and everything decays to the end. Mm. But everything around us physically is cycles.
Mm.
And the contrary to you're saying that the hills in New Zealand will eventually wear out and become like Australia is that we're on the edge of those tectonic forces here. We're by two edges, which is a permaculture thing, but the energy under the earth is creating cycles and shifting the tectonic plates around, and that's creating renewal.
Yep.
And so the real story is not that there's a beginning and an end and there's entropy. The real story is that there's cycles.
And how do we work with those cycles and harness those natural flows when they're available? And thinking about the opportunity and going, well, what are the flows that are around me now that I can be investing in for the long term? How can those serve me and my family, this land that I'm on and this community in a way that will encourage long-term prosperity?
Yeah, and we're good at tapping into flows, but we're not good at completing the cycle, the circle.
And we're not necessarily that good at investing those flows back into longer-term cycles.
Yeah, and we've got, I mean, for years now, the last decade or so in the Waikato region, we've been aware that we've reached the point where we can't take any more water out of the system in the Waikato region because not just the river, but the system. Yeah, and we're okay here in Raglan. We get our town water supply from the mountain, but one day the town might be big enough to take too much water out of that great store of under the mountain, but we don't consider that in the decision making.
So on that note, I mean, imagine how different our maybe kind of politics and governance would be if a prerequisite for all development was the regeneration of natural capital. So basically all development needed to contribute to the life support systems of Whangaroa, and otherwise you couldn't do a development. Even if it was sustainable, if it was 100% less bad, if it didn't further degrade, you still wouldn't be able to do it. It has to be life supporting, life enhancing.
Do we even know how to do that?
Yeah.
Can we create a subdivision like that?
Yeah. I mean, people have been doing it for quite a long time, I would say. But
can we create a nice saleable subdivision?
Yeah, well, so this is where we do have some challenges, right?
Yeah.
Because, again, as you pointed out really early on, ecology and economics have become very separated. And, you know, I don't know if I've shared this before, but they have the same root, right? Ecos. So one's about knowledge of the home, the other's about managing the home.
You shouldn't have to explain that to us, but yeah, it's a state of the world that we do need to explain that.
Yeah, so the way we manage the home is now completely divorced from our knowledge of the home.
Yeah. Alrighty, look, I think we've come to the point where we can wrap things up. Have you got any final words for us about catch and store energy, the permaculture design principle?
I guess I've got a few maybe local examples of how I think that showed up, and I might share those just really quickly.
Yeah, give us those,
So it could be everything from, you know, farm dams and ponds.
Yeah.
Of course, of which there's a lot. There's a lot of forest gardens in and around Whangaroa, and some of them are more mature than others. Some of them are, you know, kind of, you know, whatever, 1 to 5 years old, but some of them are 10 plus years old.
Yeah.
And I think for those who don't know what a forest garden is, it's a... or a food forest. It's a forest that functions as a typical forest, but it has, you know, food, fiber, fuel, medicine, etc. And it can provide things like, a whole range of stuff. Even forestry, and, you know, not all forestry is equal, but forestry is a way of catching and storing energy. And again, we can do sustainable yield, and we can diversify the timbers we're growing. But I think on a lot of our steep erodible slopes, forestry is actually brilliant.
Yeah.
And then obviously you've mentioned it before, but the work of Extreme Zero Waste, they're really good at capturing and storing materials before they exit the system and allowing them to be recaptured and reused. We've got some passive solar buildings and some really good ecological architects in Whangaroa who are, you know, have built some beautiful buildings that, I think hold inspiration about how we can build long-term sustainable buildings with local materials. And then there's really awesome organizations like Raglan Naturally, Raglan Community Radio, Whangaroa Environment Center, etc., that are doing a lot of stuff to use those flows to harness or improve human capital at a local level. So how are we reinvesting in the culture of this place, the people of this place.
Yeah. And there's also Community Energy Whangaroa.
Yeah.
Specifically to that point. And I think I'm interviewing them tomorrow. Yeah. Nice. I've got some emails from Tanya over the weekend, which I haven't replied to yet. Cool. But
And then Harborcare too, and the great work that Fred and others have done over the years in really trying to re-cloak our waterways that lead into the harbor.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, in some ways the most obvious example of catch and store energy and, you know, as a way of a long-term investment to protect our natural environment.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in.